Thank you, Henare. You're listening to Good Morning New Zealand. It's 8:30, time for the news. We'll be back with our discussion on the Treaty of Waitangi after this. Here's Hewitt Humphrey.
Evidence given during the State Service Commission of Inquiry into the Māori loan affair is understood to clash directly with claims made by central figures in the present furore. Despite claims yesterday by the Māori Affairs agent in the negotiations, Rocky Cribb, that he'd told the Commission the Minister was aware of the loan on October the 20th, it appears his statements to the Commission say otherwise. Radio New Zealand News understands that, in fact, transcripts taken during the interviews by the Commission of Inquiry, under oath before Christmas, conflict directly with the claims now being made by Mr. Cribb. Further reported comments of Māori Affairs Secretary Tamati Reedy that the loan and ministerial travel plans by Koru Wetari were also canvassed during the October meeting do not seem to gel with transcripts of evidence during the Commission hearing. Lower Hutt police say the light aircraft that crashed last night, killing three people, had diverted from its original Paraparaumu to Christchurch flight path and was heading for Wellington Airport when the accident occurred. The Piper Aztec aircraft crashed and burnt on the side of a ridge in remote country at the southern end of Palliser Bay. The crash happened at about 11:20 last night, and police can't say at this stage why the plane had diverted from its original flight path to head for Wellington. A police team from Lower Hutt and an inspector of air accidents are on their way to the crash site on the Orongorongo station, and it's expected to take some time to recover the bodies of the three men who died. It could also be some time before the accident victims' names are released. The head of the S-Corp Group Trust, at present being investigated by the Securities Commission over insider trading, says he'll go to the gallows first before he reveals the names of the people who give him information. Stephen Spellman says he's made an oath to his clients and informants that he won't reveal their identities, and he's going to stick to it. The S-Corp Group Trust says it gets inside information from company directors, stockbrokers and the media, which it then sells to investors. The Securities Commission's hearing into the matter has been adjourned after Mr. Spellman refused to reveal the identity of his informants. Mr. Spellman says the Commission can take the matter to court and try to make him reveal the information, but he says even if the court rules that he should disclose the identities, he won't. He says it's a matter of personal conscience. Mr. Spellman says he's spoken to some of his informants who are concerned they may be identified, but he assured them he won't break his agreement with them. An Auckland accountant believes small businesses are suffering because of delays in the handling of GST refunds from the tax department. John Gilbert, a specialist in tax accounting, says Inland Revenue is slow in processing returns, forwarding refunds and answering queries. He says in one instance the department has yet to reply to a query submitted last July. He says that small businesses with a cash flow problem are most affected and considerable sums of money are involved. Mr. Gilbert predicts the situation will worsen as the financial year draws to an end and Inland Revenue staff are diverted to income tax matters. Measuring extra quality years gained from surgery against its costs may become the future method of choosing hospital priorities. The Minister of Health, Michael Bassett, says quality-adjusted life years, called QALYs for short, will become the Bible for hospital boards when they're forced to make choices in how money is spent.
For instance, the evidence shows that for a given amount of expenditure, you'll be able to help seven times more people with hip transplants and give them quality years than you would, say, for heart transplants. And coronary bypasses much more effective than heart transplants. And that sort of work is the sort of work which is very relevant to boards when they struggle to get the best return they can for a health dollar.
Dr. Bassett told a conference of junior doctors in Dunedin the QALYs developed at York University have been greeted with a high degree of acceptance in England. The author of a police report on domestic violence believes the attitude of the police is changing for the better when it comes to dealing with domestic rows. Sergeant Greg Ford is recommending that the police reverse their present policy and arrest people more often when called to domestic disputes. Mr. Ford's recommendation is based on a study in Hamilton where police changed their policy and made arrest the first option in domestic rows. He says the police in Hamilton quickly accepted that they have a major role in dealing with both parties in domestic agencies. Police Commissioner Mal Churches says the policy won't be introduced nationally until discussions with groups involved in treating the victims of domestic violence are held. Five prominent New Zealanders are today honoured with a newly created title, the Order of New Zealand. The Prime Minister describes the new order as a significant further step in the evolution of royal honours distinctive to this country. Those awarded the Order of New Zealand are the Māori Queen, Dame Te Ata Irangi Kāhu, educationalist Dr. Clarence Beebe, FOL Vice President Sonia Davies, Sir Edmund Hillary and Sir Arnold Nordmeyer. Now the weather forecast to midnight tonight. Over the North Island, fine except for isolated showers in the west this morning. In Nelson, Marlborough, Canterbury and Otago, fine. In the west from Buller to Fiordland, scattered showers. In Southland, showers becoming confined to the western high country and the coast this morning. And for the Chatham Islands, a few showers. That's national and international news and weather to 24 minutes to 9.
You're listening to Good Morning New Zealand on National Radio. We're looking at the issues of Waitangi Day. And on the line now, we have Matthew Rata, leader of the Mana Motuhake Party. Kia ora, Matthew. At least I think we've got him there. I can't hear him. He, I hope, can hear me. Can you hear me, Matthew? No. Well, we'll try and sort out the problem there and get back to him and hear his view on the treaty just as soon as we can. But meantime, in the studio with me, we have Geoffrey Palmer, the Minister of Justice, Bishop Manu Bennett and Rebecca Evans, and in the studios in Auckland, Professor Keith Sorensen. I wonder if we could look at this question of partnership and to what extent the treaty should be seen as a document of partnership or, if you like, a charter for partnership. It's something which came out, Bishop, I know, in the deliberations of the Anglican Commission on Biculturalism. But, Rebecca, is that how you see the document?
Yes, I think that that's the way it's been interpreted at present, but I certainly believe that part of the intention of some of my ancestors in signing the treaty was that they engaged in the exercise of being hosts to or offering the hospitality of our people, I think, to people that came at that time with the intention of, whether or not the intention was that it was going to be a long-term relationship is another matter.
They might have thought they'd go home in 30 years, as it were.
Well, yeah. And there's probably some dreadful people in the country at the moment that are still hoping that a few might. But, you know, those arguments like that, I think, are a bit of tangential. But I think 147 years later, we have to look at the document as a base document, perhaps for continuing and building towards building a democratic country towards the year 2000. In my experience over the last 10 or 13 years, there's certainly been a lot of conflict about the treaty, whether or not it should be celebrated because of the fact that it hasn't been ratified. And I think if people isolate and distinguish between what are the issues, whether they be legal, constitutional, whatever, then perhaps we can get on with the business of sorting out what exactly should be done with the document and what sort of models of behaviour or models of society that we can take from enshrining the document, whether it be in the Constitution on its own or whatever. I have some strong personal opinions, obviously, about what should be done with the treaty. I do, of course, concur with the findings of the National Hui of 1984, and I did challenge, I think, both or would challenge both administrations to do something about the treaty, whether that be, you know, and not just by reference. But I think it's the time is high and it's well advanced now into the 1980s, and I think that both administrations should look seriously, or both major political parties in the country should look seriously at this whole question of the feasibility of ratification, whether it be in the existing form or taking principles of the treaty. I think that there's a certain strain of opinion within Māoridom that, speaking in Māori, says that it is a tapu document that should be left as is, enshrined as is, and whatever the courts may choose to do with it afterwards is a matter for the courts. But we've got to get the first issue right first before we proceed any further.
We've been having a little problem getting through to Matthew Rata. We're not the only people having problems. I've just been handed a note to mention that the 1YA transmitter has apparently been off the air for the past half hour with a problem up there, but I think they've now got that sorted out. So Auckland listeners, welcome back to the program. And also, let's have another go and seeing if we can get through. Matthew Rata, can you hear me? Good morning.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. Now, we're talking about the treaty. I wonder how you see the treaty document today and what you want to see done with it.
Well, for some years, of course, like most Maori people, we've always regarded the treaties perhaps the most important experience that New Zealand's ever had and likely to have. I think we've reached a stage now where Maori people want to see results, want to see some function which recognises the agreement which their forefathers had entered into. For that very reason, we set about almost a decade ago and wrote or attempted to bring about the first law for arrangement for the treaty in the terms of the Waitangi Tribunal. Now, I regarded it at that time and still do as a first initial and important step, both in legal and also in political terms, to do something constructive about giving effect to the terms and the spirit of the Treaty of Waitangi.
Keith Sorensen, you're listening in Auckland to this discussion. I wonder if you have a comment that you'd like to make at this point.
Yes, perhaps two comments. First of all, on the question of partnership, going back to something Ripika said, it's true, I think, that the Maori chiefs who signed the treaty did expect the governor or to share in a partnership with the governor. I think their main hope then was that the governor would help them to control incoming Pākehā colonists. And their feeling on the treaty since then might well be that they haven't had a lot of help in that respect. Now, partnership, of course, is a very difficult concept and particularly difficult in a situation in which you have a majority population, the Pākehā population, and the Tangata Whenua have become a minority. And it's been very difficult to ensure that the minority has had a proper share in that partnership. It's very easy to slip into a situation where there's a senior partner and a junior partner. And again, I think there's probably been a feeling that Maoris haven't shared properly in that partnership. The other thing, I think, is the question of ratification. Again, it's true, as Ripika says, that the treaty hasn't been formally ratified. Though a lot of steps have been taken which more or less amount to a kind of ratification. Ratification is a very complex sort of document in international law, but the treaty has been recognised in various ways. It was published in the London Gazette in 1840 after it had been sent home by Hobson, and some people say, well, that amounted to a ratification. The treaty's been published many times since then, very often as schedules to acts, and some people have said, well, that amounts, or almost amounts to a ratification. That can easily be a red herring. I think what we should be looking at is the fact that I think the treaty is now recognised as a proper treaty, and in that respect, I think both sides have an obligation to respect it, indeed to respect the two texts of the treaty.
If we could pick up this issue of ratification, first with you, Matthew Ratta, and then with Geoffrey Palmer. Does it worry you? Do you want to have it somehow enshrined in legislation, Matthew Ratta?
Yes, I think that the fact that we had taken steps in the terms of the Waitangi Tribunal, in my view, is but the first step towards what would be an arrangement which gives some recognition or a form of ratification that was not possible before. Because primarily the whole exercise requires political judgment because that's what it is finally, that's what we're involved in now. Maori people as a whole have long regarded the Treaty of Waitangi as the charter of their rights, and for that reason it's unavoidable that some formal action in the form of ratification or in the form that it has taken, should be so adopted.
Geoffrey Palmer.
Well, the Bill of Rights proposal we were discussing before is, of course, the ultimate ratification because it provides the treaty with the status of a higher form of law. But, you see, the discussion about ratification seems to me to be a shorthand version for describing a much more serious problem, and that serious problem is that the constitutional position of Maori interests and Maori rights have never been properly addressed, and because there is no constitutional or institutional means which works of redressing them, there is a continual failure in that area, and it is that failure which we are addressing. And I think that it's important to remember that you've got the political way of trying to address these grievances and passing laws in Parliament and having Māori people represented there. And I think that you'd have to say that in terms of looking at treaty issues and the protection of them by Parliament over the full course of New Zealand's history, that that had not been a successful method. You then could say that the treaty therefore should take on the force of law, and those means may be a more successful method. There have been some cases in the courts recently, the fishing case in the South Island, which I think shows that the attitude and sensitivities of the courts to these matters has altered and is beginning to flower and flourish. But you see, what we are really talking about is something that the Royal Commission on Electoral Law recently analysed in some detail, and they came up to the conclusion that there needed to be consultations and discussions with a very wide range of representatives of the Māori people about the definition and the protection of the rights of Māori people and the recognition of their constitutional position in this land, because the legitimacy of government in New Zealand stems to a very large extent, in my judgment, from this treaty. It is the document which makes government in New Zealand legitimate. Now, that being the case, and the fact that there are these long-standing grievances, we have to address those grievances if we are to have a future in this country. If we don't address them successfully, if we do not arrive at institutional means of bringing greater harmony than we have, then our future is not a happy one. And I think it's incumbent on all New Zealanders to recognise that stark fact.
Bishop Manu, the Anglican Church has dealt with exactly this problem just recently. I mean, the constitution of the church is being rewritten to cover this. Now, how has it managed to achieve that without a great deal of acrimony?
Well, this is you're dealing with different body, constitutional body, when you're dealing with the church and you're dealing with one denomination.
But you still have the areas of partnership and a junior and a senior partner, it seems, up until now. The role of the Māori bishop was very much downplayed by the church as a whole, although obviously it was important to Māori people. And it's only in the last few years that the church as a whole has said, yeah, you're right. And lifted the status of the Māori bishop.
Well, you have an element within the church that you don't have generally in the ordinary public, and that is the element based on the principle of brotherhood that is basic to the church's fellowship. So you see, it's much easier for the Māoris to say, okay, well, if this is true in the church, then we ought to be partners. And there was a very little. They were very. When the case was put to them properly, there was no way they could escape from that argument.
Can the same case not be put to the nation then in this case?
I wonder if I could come back in here just for a moment.
Surely.
Yes, the first thing I want to do is to, I think, refer to the question of the Bill of Rights. One of the big fears that Māori people have is the fact that, however laudable the idea of a Bill of Rights may be, and no one would be opposed to preserving the individual rights of its citizens, there ought not to be a substitute, because that's what it is regarded by Māori people, an attempt to substitute the Treaty of Waitangi in the Bill of Rights. I think they both stand, as it were, separate and important in themselves, and that what we must be very careful about is to make certain and enshrining it in the terms of a Bill of Rights, that it is not substituted, but an enforcement of what it stands for, what it means. The second one I want to add is by far the greatest that Parliament can give in terms of recognition and meaningful recognition is to make certain it does not drag its feet on the recommendations of the Waitangi Tribunal. Criticism has been levelled in that the political decision and the processes there have been far too slow to match the very, very earnest study of the Waitangi Tribunal, because that is the one area that could lay open, if you like, what Māori people may regard as yet another attempt to usurp their rights in that way. And so those two matters, as I see them, are important in themselves, and preserve it by all means, but not substitute it, and make certain that the Waitangi Tribunal's decisions are acted upon, particularly at a political level.
Well, that seems to be a direct challenge to you, Geoffrey Power.
Well, I think that the record of the governments on the Waitangi Tribunal recommendations is pretty good. The response has been as rapid as the system can provide it. You have to remember, for example, in the series of decisions that were recently announced about the Manukau Harbour, I mean, the number of departments that were involved in those decisions were extraordinary. I mean, just about every department of state had an interest in some facet of those recommendations. They all had to earnestly report on them. They all had to come to a cabinet committee. We spent hours on it at a cabinet committee. The papers were about an inch and a half thick. And we made all those decisions, and they've all been announced, and some of them have to have more study and more things done to implement them, but all of them have been made. And I think it's been proved clearly that that tribunal really has been a great success. Its jurisdiction has now been extended, its membership's been extended, it's been given a research arm so that the older claims can be looked into with greater degree of thoroughness. A lot of the history of these things is pretty complicated and has to be unearthed in a proper way, and it's now got a research arm to do that. I think that has been a success story, no question about it, but it is, I think, only a step on a way to some further progress. There have been a lot of discussions, for example, about whether there should be a Senate, which the Māoris have, and I have to tell you that those suggestions seem to me to be grasping at a new constitutional framework for settling of these issues, which we haven't yet quite got to, and we have to get there, because if we don't get there, we will not be able to preserve the sort of socially just system which every citizen must have the right to expect, or the person or the citizen will find that the government of the country is not a legitimate government. And when you get that sort of situation, you have got the prospect of unrest on a wide scale, and we've got to find institutions to deal with these things.
I wonder if I could ask the Minister a question in regard to the Treaty of Waitangi and the Bill of Rights. Is it possible for the Bill of Rights to be able to set apart the Treaty of Waitangi as the chief point of reference for all legislation to be created in New Zealand?
Yes, the purpose of putting it in the Bill of Rights is to say when an Act of Parliament is passed, an ordinary Act of Parliament, it must be consistent with the provisions of the Treaty. If it is not, it is struck down. And that is a very important provision, because it means that in fact ordinary legislation must always be tested against the provisions in the treaty to ensure that the ordinary legislation passed by Parliament is consistent with the provisions of the treaty. If you look back historically, I think especially in some of the 19th century things, take the Tauhanga Suppression Act. I have no doubt that the Tauhanga Suppression Act was contrary to the Bill of Rights that I am proposing. And that it was contrary to the treaty, obviously. Yet it was passed by a Pākehā majority in the New Zealand Parliament. It's since been repealed, of course, but that's not the point. The point is that there was no adequate protection against the invasion of those rights because the majority ruled in the Parliament. Now, there are not sufficient checks and balances, therefore, in our system to ensure that the rights that the Māoris have under the treaty are sufficiently addressed in the making of legislation. And in the making of legislation, many people's rights are determined.
But I wonder if we could go one step further than that, though, Minister, with the question of the Bill of Rights and what might happen with the Treaty 2, either within or outside of it, and the whole question of entrenchment, and who might have the power to overturn decisions that emanate either from the courts or as a result of having some sort of constitution. And the criticism that I, you know, am heard of and probably have heard of and probably am party to as well is this whole question of lack of an entrenching clause or lack of proposal of such a clause in respect to the Bill of Rights. Because I think that one, you know, what I was conscious of in the earlier discussions this morning was really probably a lack of awareness or understanding in the greater majority of the Māori populace about really the significance of the treaty and what significance it might have in 20 or 30 years' time. And I think that, that's why it was probably good that a number of younger people have been included in this type of debate, because they're going to be the ones that are going to be beneficiaries of whatever we create now. And I certainly wouldn't like to see a situation in 30 years' time where Māori people are constantly, have been for 30 years, litigants, and have sought by way of the courts redress for any sort of grievances, whether it be land, forest, fisheries, that sort of thing. That's why I think that a narrow interpretation of the treaty and taking it up, or really saying to Māori people that we must pursue redress through the courts, is probably involving them in an unduly long process. And I think there must be some safer guarantee than a clause or a bill or an act of Parliament that is able to be overturned by any administration.
Well, I don't think any provision in the treaty could be overturned by anyone any time. I mean, it's not susceptible to Parliament to alter a treaty that was made in 1840. It's not susceptible to the New Zealand public to do it by referendum. It just is not a possible thing to do. The argument that you could somehow amend the treaty when you're amending the Bill of Rights is not correct. But I think it's important to try and explain that the significance of this isn't in continual journeys to the courts. Mm. The significance is to place some rules which the government itself is bound by, that all the departments of state and the government laws themselves, when they're being made, say, hey, we better pay attention to the treaty here and make sure that what we're doing here is not contrary to it. That is a very important safeguard, which the system really has ignored in the past.
I think, if I can, I think too, what we've got to bear in mind is whether the Bill of Rights is enacted or not will not make the Treaty of Waitangi in the judgment of Maori people any less valued or relevant. I think we should regard any enactment within the framework of the Bill of Rights as a bonus, which enhances the actual meaning, the application and the practice of the Treaty of Waitangi. And while I accept and commend the government for much of what it has done in the terms of the Waitangi Tribunal and also in the promotion of the full meaning of the Treaty of Waitangi, for Maori people it is important to understand and accept that it is not made irrelevant or secondary, if you like, to an attempt to enforce it by way of a Bill of Rights.
I'm going to have to chip in there, Matthew. Thank you all for joining us. We have trouble with time on radio. We always do. The discussion always needs to go on longer than we have available. Thank you all for joining us. We've been talking to Matthew Rata. Professor Keith Sorensen's been in the studio in Auckland, in the studio with me here in Wellington, Rebecca Evans, Minister of Justice, Geoffrey Palmer, my co-host for the programme this morning, Bishop Manu Bennett. And we're going to end, in fact, with words from Bishop Bennett at the Hui at Ngarawa Wahia in 1984.
But now we've learned to listen to each other, we are also learning how to tolerate each other. And if we tolerate each other, then this is the first step towards a unified and a happier community.
Hikoi, pick up your second-hand soul, lost for the Union Jack and a peppermint star. Catch the heat of beer and tears. What a good day for a walk, I with Papa Tuanuku. Ehoa, let's walk together, never alone. Why then, on this hikoi, are you walking to Waitangi in the jackboots of the Pākehā? Nau mai e